Welcome to Upvote, a politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. Each week until the election, we'll be discussing the increasingly important relationship between politics and technology, which more and more is coming to define political life in ways that are profound and, let's face it, occasionally scary. I'm Roland Manthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired. With me are Kelly Fiveash, News Editor of Ars Technica.
Hello.
And our special guest, Martha Lane Fox, who you'll probably know as the founder of LastMinute.com and .everyone, a member of the Twitter board and the House of Lords, and a digital champion who has shaped tech policy under both Gordon Brown and David Cameron. In fact, we're sitting in her beautiful living room right now. Hello, Martha.
This is a dining room, you idiot.
How embarrassing. What a fool I am.
It's very nice to meet you both. Thanks for coming here.
Our pleasure. Thank you. We'll be discussing the election, Brexit, and Martha's newish tech-driven political startup, More United, which is backing candidates in seats across the country. But first, a word from our sponsors. Pickfair is where a new generation of photographers sell images to businesses across the globe. You know the iPhone posters? Those shots taken on an iPhone 6? Well, they're sold on Pickfair. If your business is looking for stunning, authentic images to use for your website, or your marketing, or social media and blogs, Pickfair doesn't force you into a subscription or make you buy credits. You can just head to the website and buy them off the shelf. And they're affordable too. Images start from £1 to license. And, best of all, Pickfair is fair. They're the only image licensing platform that ensures the photographers see the vast majority of the money generated by their images. Head to pickfair.com, that's P-I-C-F-A-I-R, for images that will set your business apart. And now on with the show. So, Martha, it's just over a week since Theresa May called a general election. What did you think when you heard we were going to be doing this all over again?
I was just getting in a taxi and I was shouted at by the taxi driver, "Have you heard what's happened?" I thought, oh, now what? Has there been another attack somewhere? And he was shouting about the election, which I thought was quite interesting because I thought maybe he'd be putting his head in his hands and being exhausted. So that was where I was. And I remember thinking, yeah, not surprising, actually.
Are you supporting anyone in this election, officially?
I'm not allowed to support anyone officially because I'm a crossbench peer, I'm an independent one, and we have no political views. We make our mind up based on the issue in front of us. And as a double whammy, I can't vote. So I'm feeling as though I've got my hands crossed at the minute, but they are literally tied. I'm desperate to speak about stuff and I can't really be overtly political.
But you are taking a political role with More United, which is a Lib Dem organisation?
No, it's not a Lib Dem organisation. I certainly wouldn't be involved with it if it was. The reason I got involved with More United, and I'm just an ambassador for the organisation, is because after Brexit, it was one of the few actual things that was being made and built. And I like actual things. You know, I think a lot of people were going around saying, oh, this is a disaster, what can we do, and shouting about it and making demands and doing stuff. But here were some people actually building a thing. And that thing is very simple. It's a way of funding candidates who have progressive beliefs. And so More United has a political point of view in that it believes in a bunch of stuff, a close relationship to the EU, a sustainable economy, some things that I believe as well. But they're not left or right. They're quite centrist. We want to be able to support candidates from both sides of the political spectrum, and more importantly, try and encourage people who maybe otherwise would not have had sources of political funding open to them, suddenly have those opened up.
Okay, so, I mean, how long has this movement been going on? I mean, it's
not long, only 3-4 months.
Yeah.
And it was built after Brexit. Certainly, I don't think imagined that there'd be a general election quite so quickly. Mm-hmm. They've worked on some of the by-elections that have happened to date. And the model's clever. It, you know, builds both a volunteer base, but also a funding base, and not only encourage people to be able to give cash to candidates, but also to go out and fight on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So it's mobilising both on and offline.
Okay, but is it becoming a bit of a crowded market for movements such as this? Because it seems like we're seeing a lot of these kind of movements being created post-Brexit.
That's interesting. I can't think of another thing. I can't think of another platform that's an independent platform without a political, overtly left or right point of view. I think you can hear my cat with her point of view in the background there. So I'm interested in what you think is similar to this. I don't know any, and that's why I find it compelling.
So tell us about Brexit then, or let's talk about Brexit.
I'm in charge of Brexit.
I mean, you've been strongly against it from the start, and the conventional wisdom is that Brexit will be bad for tech. Why is that?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think Brexit will be quite bad for Britain, and I am an optimistic person and I accept that it is happening. I don't necessarily accept it as the will of the people. I think that's a kind of terrible populist slogan. People were asked whether they wanted to be in or out of the EU. There were no terms in which people were voting. It was a very simplistic way of looking at the problem. So I believe very deeply this is a huge challenge for us as a country. You know, focusing on tech specifically, you know, tech is the ultimate global connected marketplace, you know, and I find it just interesting that there is any debate that in the tech sector we shouldn't try be trying to make as many links as possible to as many countries, not just the EU, but broadly as well. The specific relationship with the EU and the tech sector is, you know, multifaceted. We have a huge number of people that come from Europe to work in our sector. We also obviously have very close geographical ties, so therefore people often move from our country to their next startup place to be either Paris or Berlin or somewhere where we have close links. And it's just very depressing because, as we were talking about before we started recording, the entire European tech sector, as in the ownership of European tech, is 7% of that of the US. 7%, the entire European sector. So if we really are trying to build scale businesses with value being created for people in Europe, it's going to be a challenge, and it's going to be even more of a challenge for Britain when we take ourselves out of that.
Traditionally, the tech sector has supported the Conservatives, really.
That's interesting.
Do you think that's going to change?
I think that's quite right. I think that my view is actually slightly different, which is, as a very old person who's worked in this for such a long time, you know, I can remember going to Number 10 as a completely green tech entrepreneur, probably in about 1999. Tony Blair had just won, and I was invited to a round table to talk about business, and I think I was really the only person there from the tech sector, quite out of my depth, full stop. But it was, to me, interesting that, you know, the Labour Party, as it was gaining kind of power, was becoming more close to the tech sector. So I think that the reason that there's been a closer link between the Tories and tech is because that's the point at which both the tech sector has grown and become more important to the economy, that the Tories became in power. And actually, there were a bunch of advisers like Rohan Silver who did a lot to forge those links between the sector. And I don't think it was overtly political. I think it was more just because of the pragmatic nature of where we were in the political cycle.
Okay, I mean, you've been involved in shaping tech policy, as you say, under both Labour and the Conservative-led governments. First on the big thing that you've championed, which is digital inclusion, but then with your vision for GDS as well. Many argue that's been with mixed results. So there's examples there such as the emphasis on web publishing, for example, and claims of design over substance. There's also a suggestion of a failure to learn from the mistakes and successes of its predecessor, DirectGov. And sorry to keep the list coming, but there's also the delayed ID system, Verify, that HMRC has already distanced itself from. So do you find the GDS criticism hard to stomach, and will you be advising the next government on tech policy?
Firstly, I think that it would be astonishing if you were trying to undertake the revolution at the heart of government if there weren't massive and big and small failures along the way, you know, inevitably. Of course GDS has done some things wrong, as they would be the first to put their hands up and say, but I would just take issue with a couple of those specific points. You know, the web publishing point, that was very clearly because that was the one that we needed to get going, because that was what most people were doing. You know, if you start with users, that was the thing that was going to make the biggest difference. And some of those big transactional services are coming and have been coming, and there's a plan to, you know, keep them churning out. If you look at something like DVLA, fabulous improvement in how you get your driving license online. So that was a conscious choice. I believe it was the right choice. I think that the transactional services are going to continue to roll and get better and better and better. And secondly, you know, you picked up on Verify. Verify is an astonishingly good programme. GDS are desperate to push that through. Janet Hughes, the brilliant woman who ran it, who now works with me at .everyone, is, you know, puts her head in her hands if she sees government slowing it down. These are massive cultural shifts, you know. I think that actually the criticism you didn't mention, which you could definitely level directly against me as opposed to the team, is perhaps we didn't address the cultural shift enough that happened in government. You know, we chose to build a central team to have kind of dual controls between departments and central government. And I'm not sure if that was the right strategy. And if it was, we probably should have won more people over with a more concerted charm offensive over a longer period of time, because this is difficult. You know, people's jobs were changing. You can't shift enormous structures just like government overnight. And I think that the view that GDS took to do things quickly and to get on with some brilliant user-led services was right, but it probably needed to go in parallel with more of a cultural change programme happening in departments. You know, I spent a lot of time with secretaries of state, with different ministers, with people who ran departments, but I probably definitely couldn't do it alone. And I think that was maybe where we needed to keep addressing the huge transformation that had to happen in people's minds as much as in their behaviours.
Okay, so as I asked you earlier as well, off the back of that question, will you be advising the next government and currently as well with Prime Minister May? I mean, what has been your experience so far in terms of talking to her about tech policy? She's not the sort of cosy Conservative that we've all known from David Cameron's days. So
no, she is not.
Is there a different style, and is that?
I don't know Theresa May personally. Mm. I've talked to her advisers. I don't formally advise the government anymore because since becoming an independent peer, I've stepped back from being digital champion. I still help GDS as much as I can. I still care deeply about the role the UK can play in the world. I care about digital as part of that, but I'm not. I don't come at this from what the tech sector needs and to kind of shouting about the tech sector. I'm actually more interested in what the tech sector can do, what digital can do to help more people in the country, as opposed to building more startups, which I think is very important, but I don't believe is going to completely change the shape of the UK. You know, of course, we need to try and keep innovating, of course, but I'm interested in how we can put technology at the heart of how we think about some of our more intractable social problems. So those are the areas that interest me.
Because you also do a different kind of public service in a way by sitting on the board of Twitter.
Yep.
What's that like?
Well, because I'm sure not very many people are listening to this podcast, it's all nuts, right? No, I'm teasing. It's I didn't know Silicon Valley very well before I started being on the board of Twitter. For personal reasons, due to my insane car accident, I hadn't travelled there a lot over the last 10 years. So it's been fascinating for me to see a bit more close up that incredible community and why the power lies so amazingly locally there. I love being on board of Twitter. It is an extraordinary organisation. Yes, complicated, inevitably has challenges, but I believe does perform a sort of public service. And it's this very complicated problem because you've got to find the very strong business model in this incredible product and make sure that we still deliver on a very complicated set of different things. People wanting freedom of expression, but also not allowing abuse on the platform. All of the complexities that anyone that's a user knows.
Is it really that complicated, though, stopping abuse on Twitter?
No, that's not complicated, sorry. I meant protecting freedom of expression in the right way as opposed to slamming down the wrong people. You know, lots of people who are on Twitter are anonymous because they don't want to be found out, because if they are, then they'll be shut down. So a lot of people, I'm just giving you an example, a lot of people are calling for no anonymity on Twitter. So you have some complex challenges in terms of how do you position what the right level of freedom of expression is. I agree with you, it's not complicated to shut down abuse, and we're doing a massive amount with the products and tools that have been rolled out over this year to try and nail that. It has been too slow. It will happen quicker, I'm absolutely sure. It's absolute number one priority on the system. But there are some cases where it's not completely clear exactly what the right thing to do is. Should you kick this person off? I don't know, are they being abused? You know, there's some things that are a little bit more in the balance for me.
Is it really Twitter's number one priority then,
yes,
stopping abuse?
Yes.
Not growing as a platform?
No, that of course, but in terms of the product refinements, I think I can say with pretty much certainty that Jack would say himself that they were too slow to make it the central plank of some of the improvements they're making. Of course they're inventing new bits of the platform. Of course they're doing new tech tools for the advertisers. But for users, it has been it's been one of the most important issues for so long. They are really trying to nail this.
Okay, so what about the proliferation of so-called fake news on Twitter and other services?
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's come from nowhere. And I think every site is trying to work out how to deal with it. I'm certainly not the person to sit here with the answers, but it's an extremely important problem, not just for Twitter and its credibility and Facebook and its credibility. Actually, Facebook probably slightly more, Twitter's a different relationship to fake news, but more importantly, for us as citizens and engaged people in the world. You know, I think that this is a real moment of shift and change, and it feels a bit as though the internet's gone from the sort of heady excitement to be a teenage where, oh my goodness, we're facing quite a lot of these problems. What are the solutions to these problems? And I don't know all the answers, but I'm confident that we can get to them because people are pretty smart.
I mean, it's becoming more of an issue now for politicians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the House of Lords has just been discussing the Digital Economy Bill, which one observer has described as a sort of Christmas tree of the government desires, if you like. So how important an issue is it for you in terms of actually being in Parliament and having a say there?
I think two things occur to me. Firstly, I still feel, and this is what everyone has been trying to help address, that the level of digital understanding among our public officials is not high enough. And I don't mean that as a criticism necessarily, because it's not high enough in lots of places, but it's partly just the experience. You know, we're lucky, we work in the sector, we sort of understand it. I've done digital stuff my whole working life. I'm still all at sea. I don't have the answers to lots of things. So I think the first thing for me is to try and help MPs, Lords, anybody affecting legislation, making decisions about our public policy and public life, to understand a bit more deeply what the internet is, what it is enabling, what is happening. And Dot Everyone, my organisation, has done some stuff to try and help mentor MPs into this. We're going to do some more, but it can't just be one organisation alone. So I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing is I do also think that we could be tougher on some of these platforms. And I do think that it's going to be important over time to make sure that they're reactive, that they are producing tools and software that is able to cope with this stuff. You know, some of the brightest brains on the planet are designing these systems. And I think it's important that they're deployed to these challenges as much as they're deployed to help advertisers make more money.
Could you talk a bit more about how Dot Everyone is funded and how sort of key the government is in terms of keeping that organisation alive?
Not funded by government.
Okay.
I've raised the money from individuals and from corporates, but from no one corporate, so we're completely neutral. We've got backers like Sage, Lloyds, Google, BT, lots of different organisations and private individuals, mm-hmm. And going after foundations and money as well. So we are absolutely without any ties to corporates. They've all given money on the basis of having no say in me being able to not have to talk about things very openly, for example. And we are there to fight for a fairer internet, which is a big, bold statement. But I believe that there is still huge gains to making sure that not only the internet works for everyone, both including everyone, but also designing services that meet the needs of perhaps the furthest first, but also in understanding, you know, I think we don't really yet have this in our DNA in our country. You know, there are huge, enormous problems that we're going to face, and I believe they're going to become more profound post-Brexit, not just because we have crises in some of our public services, but also because we're going to have to deal with a complexity that we've never seen before. So a better understanding of how the internet works at all levels for all people can only be a good thing.
Because you've been championing digital literacy for a long time now.
Yes.
I mean, do you ever feel down about it?
Oh, ridiculous. I feel like, am I seriously having this conversation with people?
Again.
Do I have to convince people that access to the internet, understanding it, is really something important? But yes, it turns out I do. And I am bored sometimes and I feel like white noise and it's not glamorous and it's not cool. And I tell you what, if you're trying to go to a kind of networking bigwigs in the tech sector meeting and they're asking, what are you doing now? And you're not doing some latest cool hip thing and you're still banging on about people not understanding the internet, then they walk away from you. So yes, I think it's depressing, but I also think it's kind of important, and I don't say that in a grand way. I mean it genuinely. I think it's important at both ends of the spectrum. So I still meet people for whom their lives have been transformed when they have had access to the internet, and that is a very powerful thing, and I believe that we should all be fighting for that, and we have an obligation, if we have had success through this technology, to help more people have that success, not just become a crazy entrepreneur, but just be able to get a job. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I guess, you know, I think, and it comes back to your question about GDS, you know, we are going through a mammoth change. Catherine Parsons talks about digital enlightenment. I like that. You know, I think that the more people at any level in society that don't just know how to turn on a computer, but do understand what an API is, understand about open source, know about kind of what the methodology of agile means, understand why resilience and adaptability, to me, is what the internet more than anything has kind of facilitated and sped up, then a good thing will happen for the country. But we're a long way from that. It's not the experience of our senior public officials that they've worked in the tech sector or understood it, because why would they necessarily? I think I read the other day that there are still only 6 digital experienced non-executives on FTSE 100 boards. I mean, 6, it's nothing. So this still feels like we need to press the reset button.
Your methodology has always been to work with the big tech companies.
Yes.
The big platforms.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that maybe we should be thinking more about regulating them.
Yep.
Do you ever wonder if we should have, as a society, been more aggressive in our response to them, and whether we should be really working with them or we should be trying to regulate them more strongly?
I find this really confusing, and I'm not avoiding the question at all. I just don't really know, because it's very complicated to try and regulate a global system. You know, we can make these pockets of change and look at what the commissioner is now doing in the EU, you know, tackling some of the tax issues. But if we're taking ourselves out of the EU, then what's going to be the status of the UK, for example? And then there's a whole different bunch of stuff going on in Asia or China. It is really difficult, and that's not to avoid the question. So I think we should be looking at different regulation, and I think we should be keeping up pressure. But to me, it doesn't come from one source. I think that it comes from lots of sources. We as consumers and users also need to be more active and engaged and more educated about this stuff. You know, I think people don't appreciate what's happening to their data. I don't think people understand the dynamics of these businesses. I think that that is a challenge, and I think it is a problem. And I think hopefully organisations like .everyone can help address some of these things. But it's, to me, about all of those different pieces. It's about media, it's about policy, it's about individuals, certainly not about my cat in the background, if you can hear her. She's got, again, a very strong view about this subject. And I think we've got to try and bring all those bits together, because it is just dangerous when so much power resides in such a small number of hands.
So do you think that Brexit represents an opportunity for more regulation of the tech sector? And just to add to that as well, obviously, we don't know who's going to be the next Prime Minister. So if it is Jeremy Corbyn, for example, what's your vision of the future, if you have one?
I don't know. I think it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because on one level, some of the work people that work with Jeremy Corbyn have clearly got quite a good digital understanding. They've built a user base. You know, Momentum does use tech in quite smart ways. So it's interesting. I don't know him directly, so I don't know how it would play out. But I certainly think that Brexit is an opportunity to press the button of change. That didn't come out quite right. Hit the reset button, sorry. You know, I think that for me, if I was Prime Minister, obviously a whole lot of things might go to shit. But what I know would be true is that I would put an immense focus on, it is basically modernising everything. I would be upgrading our infrastructure, not just to 2020, but I'd be trying to imagine 2050 in 2030, and how could the UK become some powerhouse of the digital economy, because the internet's going to become more, not less. So I'd definitely upgrade our infrastructure. I'd have a massive skills programme, not just to get more people into jobs, but I'd do it for nurses, I'd do it for teachers. I'd try and completely rebalance, you know, our relationship between how parents get taught about technology and children. You know, I don't think we need to have so many aspects of the economy that we're still frightened of, or that we are not addressing using the internet as the lever for change.
Okay, I mean, you've mentioned all the key things there that the electorate will care about beyond Brexit, education, the economy and so on, at the NHS as well, of course. Do you not think tech policy might get left behind, especially given that where we are today, we don't have public services online fully yet. There's not enough engagement there. And you've said yourself that politicians struggle with these issues.
I'm actually more optimistic. I think that there is a recognition, because, you know, we have leaders that they're not all completely mad. They don't have their head in the sand. They would probably all put digital somewhere up on their priority lists, but I think often don't have the understanding and levers to know what. So, you know, and it's hard, right? You know, look at putting digital in the NHS. It's hard. These are huge, complex systems, and it's hard to break them into sizable chunks and to make meaningful difference into citizens' lives. But it has to happen, and we had to try and encourage our best brains to be thinking about these problems. So I am personally more interested and want to try, for as much as I am able with my voice, to worry about how digital affects us in our broader policy than how digital and the sector, as in the tech sector, gets more clout from politicians. I think that's being done. I think the bigger challenge for us as a country is how do we embed digital more in our regeneration as a country.
You mentioned the tech sector and its tendency to demand things for the tech sector. And I know we've talked about this before. Do you feel as if the tech sector has a share of blame, or should have a share of blame attached to it, for the political turn that's been taken lately, if you think the blame is going around?
I think it'd be hard to blame the UK tech sector for anything that's happened kind of geopolitically on a macro level. I think that's going it a bit. And, you know, in my experience, it's easy to say, oh, you know, Trump got elected because of all this online stuff, or Brexit happened because of a whole load of fake news. In my experience, it's actually still face-to-face contact, you know, people being rung up door-to-door, going out. That's what really does encourage differences in voting patterns. And, of course, they're married with incredibly now clever data systems, but it's got to go hand in hand. So I don't think the tech sector can be blamed, especially not the UK tech sector, which is relatively insignificant geopolitically. Sorry, UK tech sector, but it's not really a thing. However, I do think something a bit different, which is that we have had a lot of attention from the politicians about what the UK's tech sector might need post-Brexit. And as you know, I've spoken about how I think actually it would be interesting to talk about what the UK tech sector could do for the country post-Brexit, and how can we actually enable more to happen, not just for our own benefit, but for wider communities' benefit.
And then looking forward, let's say 10 years, what will this situation that we're in look like then? Can you predict?
It's so fascinating, isn't it? You know, either things will have blown up completely and we're going to be in a totally different democratic state, or they won't, and they'll have been brought back into established norms somehow. You know, it's clear that data and the use of data is going to become more and more important. I mean, look at the role of Cambridge Analytica that's just been revealed more broadly in what's been happening over the world. So, you know, it sounds like the most trite thing to say, but there's an inevitability to more and more tech savviness in all kinds of political life. Whether I think that that will lead to completely new political systems, I'm not sure. You know, I think that even in the immensely broken democratic systems that we have, and I don't just mean in the UK, I mean, if you look at the US political system, it's hard to argue that that isn't anything except, you know, extremely corrupt on one level, only determined by amounts of money and so on. But maybe what tech will do is enable a new wave or fresh faces to emerge into the political system. You know, that's what I would hope. So, for example, I was talking to my heroine, Anne-Marie Slaughter, recently, who's a US policy advisor, and she was saying that Emily's List, the list in the US that tries to encourage women into politics, has had 10,000 women find them through online mechanisms to come to want to stand for office. So, you know, I don't know if tech is going to break the systems, but maybe it will enable the systems to change, because it will enable new conversations to happen, new people to enter. And again, I would hope that More United might have that role here in the UK.
I think that's a good place to end. Martha Lane Fox, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Our pleasure. And Kelly, thank you as well.
Thank you.
This is our first time doing this, so we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know what you think. Please get in touch on Twitter. I'm at Ros Mountthorpe. Kelly, what are you?
I'm Kelly Fiveash.
And of course, you can always tweet Martha. She actually replies.
I always reply, but my cat's not on Twitter yet, if anybody did want to have a chat about her Brexit views.
Something for next year, perhaps. Anyway, thank you very much. And we'll be recording more of these podcasts in the run-up to the election. They'll be going out weekly, so please subscribe and listen in. Thank you.